Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today. Our first topic for today has to do with the Antiques Roadshow. Marsha Bemko, who we're trying to reach right now, Jim Packard's working on it, is the executive producer for the program, and she's the author of the book Antiques Roadshow, Behind the Scenes, an insider's guide to PBS's number one weekly show. And I don't know if you've watched it or not. We've watched it many times at our home and always enjoy it. And I often wondered kind of what went behind the scenes to put a show like this together, because it's obviously there are lots and lots of people involved. You have lots of people from, obviously, who are bringing things, but then you've got the appraisers, you've got the producers, you've got the television people. And so there's a lot that goes into making a program like that, and it's one that you really can't script it too much ahead of time. You sort of have it. I think it's more the case that you sort of have a general guideline of how you want to produce the program or how you want the program to go, and then you go ahead and see what happens with all of the people who come. And that's kind of what I got from reading Marsha's book, Marsha Bemko's book. It's really fascinating to see what goes on behind the scenes. And not only what goes on behind the scenes, she also has many great stories to tell about people who have brought things to the show. I remember reading in the book about a fellow who claimed to be, that was a great-grandson of Wyatt Earp, and the amount of effort it took to determine. They did an interview with him, and he had some old photos and so forth, and it was quite a story. But then when they got back to their production facilities, they had to go through the whole process of trying to figure out whether or not this guy was really related to Wyatt Earp. I think he had some glasses that he claimed were Doc Holliday's glasses. So as you can imagine, the value of something like those glasses and the photos he had supposedly of Wyatt Earp's wife or partner, at least, would be pretty valuable. And so, you'd like to think it's true. The guy kind of looked like Wyatt Earp, but whether or not it was true. Finally, in the end, they weren't able to put that part of the show on, although they did save it, and they may be able to use it someday down the road. So that's just kind of one of the stories that I found in the book. I also was interested in the book for the information it gives on just the sort of the nuts and bolts of getting tickets. There's only two per household that are allowed. I also really enjoyed learning about the original show itself. The original show was not here in the United States. The original Antiques Roadshow was in England. And so it was quite interesting as to how they had a show in England that was, I've forgotten the title of it now. It was something else. It was a show about antiques, but it was people were constantly calling in and saying, "What do you think? What is this worth? How much is this thing that I've got worth?" And so, they finally decided, maybe we could put a show together around that. And so, from that, they came up with the title of Antiques Roadshow. And went on to be a very, very popular show. It was, I think, the first program was called "Going for a Song." it was kind of an interesting title, and they'd received so many letters saying, "I've got one of those. How much is it worth?" Somebody at one of their meetings mentioned that auction houses did sweeps, where they sent two or three experts to a town for a day or two, and these people would kind of discreetly value people's items. And so the folks there wondered, well, is that going to translate into a program? And so from this meeting, that particular meeting, Antiques Roadshow, started and it grew and became, I think, something of a phenomenon on the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. A bit surprising to some, but the show was a very dramatic success. And they had 15 million viewers watching it in the UK every week at the height of its popularity. And most importantly, its audience crossed pretty much every demographic barriers. And I think the I was trying to remember, Christopher Lewis, I believe, was the one of the executive producers of the British Antiques Roadshow. And he thought it was a hit because it was a kind of a game show. And it is, in a way, you know, it's a kind of a game show, and everybody has a prize to begin with. And then the contestants, sort of, the people with the prizes, are just trying to find out if it's worth anything. And so, in a way, it's kind of a treasure hunt. And I think that's pretty much carries over to our U.S. Public broadcast program itself. It's kind of like a treasure hunt, and it's sort of like a game show because we have all these contestants who already have something. Maybe it's an old antique chair. Maybe it's, you know, whatever. Whatever it is, they already have something, and then, by golly, they have a chance to find out what the value of that is. So it's been a great program, and I've really enjoyed watching it myself, and I've really enjoyed reading this book. So I'm really pleased to be able to invite Marcia Bemko to the phones. And we have her with us, so I'm going to go to the phones here. Marcia.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I tell you what, I've just been talking a little bit about how Antiques Roadshow first started in England and then how it transferred here. How did you become involved in Antiques Roadshow?
Well, that happened about 10 years ago. I've always been, I've spent a good portion of my career with PBS, with WGBH here in Boston, who produces Antiques Roadshow for public television. And about 10 years ago, I was approached by the then executive producer to come join the show, and frankly, wasn't keen on it. Lo and behold, was the smartest thing I ever did, because it's the best time I've ever had. It's a lot of work, but this is a show that is just not only a joy to watch, but a joy to make.
I bet. Well, it certainly is a joy to watch. I can vouch for that. I'm not so sure about the joy to make. It must be. It's not like a typical television show that's fully produced and every piece is set in place before the show.
We are a reality show. As a matter of fact, we were nominated for our 7th Emmy this year as in the reality category. We don't know, other than a few pieces of furniture that we cart in, and frankly, once we see them in person, we don't always want to use them. The photographs aren't an accurate way to appraise antiques, by the way. And otherwise, we have no idea what's going to happen. What we do know is that we have given out almost about 8,000 tickets, and we're going to see about 5,000 to 6,000 people with two objects each. So we know 10,000 to 12,000 objects are coming through the door, and because we see that many, we will see enough interesting things to make 3 episodes of television.
That's an amazing amount to deal with in over the course of a day. How many people are involved?
Well, the roadshow, it's the staff grows. Right now, this time of the year, we tour in the summer. We tour in June, July, and August. As a matter of fact, one of the cities we were in this summer was Madison.
Right.
And But right now we're down to the core year-round staff, and that's about 14 of us. Not about, it is 14 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we expand for the summer, and that really grows. We travel, including us, about 45 people out of Boston, including crew and others. We work with about 110 volunteers in each city, so the Wisconsin Public Television provided us with those 110 bodies, along with the work that the station does with us. And, of course, the most important people in the room. The 75 or so experts who are there to tell us what they know about the objects that are coming through the door.
So it's
a long day because we do see, we do try and see and tell. We get stumped now and then. Occasionally we get stumped, but for the most part, people walk away knowing something.
And so it's an expensive program to produce as well.
You know, as television goes, frankly, it's an inexpensive television program because. But television is never cheap, you know. Like radio, it's always more money than people think. But it's as television goes. Frankly, we're a very, very efficient, inexpensive hour of television.
I tell you, I've really enjoyed reading your book. It's so much fun to read the behind the scenes. How do you pick your towns?
You know, I like to joke with folks that we throw darts because that's what it feels like sometimes. But as you saw in the book, there's a map on my wall, which I'm sitting here looking at. And the one fun observation that I've had with over my 10 years of being here, I've seen some of the junior people come and go. And when someone young comes in and we're trying to find where we can go, because it starts with your city has to have a convention center. We need about 80,000 square feet of space. 100,000 square is a little better even. But there are states like South Dakota. We can't go there. There's no venue for us, and we can't go. But when someone who's been here for a little bit, they look at the map and they say, oh, it's a small country. And I say, ah, welcome to Roadshow. You're really here. Because there aren't that many places to go.
And yet you can't go, as you say in your book, I don't think you can go back to the same place. What is it, every 5 years?
More than 5 years. When we've done, and I won't even say the city's name because it will make them feel bad, but when we did them a city after just 5 years, you can feel the difference. And for those of us who do every event and produce all these shows, it's a subtle thing, but we like to keep that excitement building. So an extra year or so in there helps.
Talking today with Marcia Bemko, who is executive producer for the program Antiques Roadshow, and that's the title of her book, Antiques Roadshow, Behind the Scenes. Fascinating look at what goes on to produce this program that is really a beloved program here in this country. How many people watch every week? Is it?
We're almost 10 million people. And
that's
I think
amazing.
One of the things, and I get that we try and answer in the book because there are questions I'm often asked, are the things like people always wonder, you know, what do people do with their objects after the show? Well, I will tell you, for the most part, although there's a fun Madison story, I will tell you, for the most part, no matter what it is worth, people do not sell their objects. I wanted to make a whole television series about it, but there weren't enough stories to tell. Because people go home and put it back on the wall, back on the mantelpiece. But answers to questions like that, where people assume that they know what happens, and it's counterintuitive, a lot of what happens back here, because once you part with something, a family object, by the way, usually you can't afford to buy it back.
Yeah, that's right. You said you had a great Madison story to tell?
Well, my favorite, and I feel bad for all the little favorites. It's like telling a child that it's a favorite. But my favorite appraisal from this summer's tapings is from Madison.
Oh, great.
And those who read the newspaper around there may have heard about it. It was a letter written by Frank Sinatra that the guest had bought at sort of like a little auction because she had, it was Mike Royko, the columnist.
Yeah.
And he appraised it for $15,000. She paid $400 for it back in 1976. So, but she has such a reaction, and she is so delightful and so happy that she literally, the camera has to follow her as she dances off the set. So yet another behind-the-scenes moments, but a favorite from your neck of the woods.
Want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Now, you're not an appraiser. right?
No, I know a dangerous amount about antiques. It's my problem.
So we're not, so we probably shouldn't be asking people to call in and say, I've got this old dresser. What's it worth?
And let me tell you something. One of the things that, because that is, we do a lot of answering questions, like, and one of the things, even if we had an appraiser on the line, it's like talking to our doctor about your appendix.
Yeah.
They really want to see it. And that's why, even when I mentioned about, we solicit photos for all the 8 to 10 pieces of furniture we'll move into onto our set. An appraiser comes to our office to choose those photos, and guess what? Can't tell the repros, can't tell the repairs, can't tell in a photo. So even an expert wouldn't want to do that.
If you'd like to join in, and maybe with a question or comment about the program itself, or maybe you've participated in one of the shows and have a reaction to going to the Antiques Roadshow, we'd love to hear that, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Talking today with Marcia Bemko, who is executive producer and author of Antiques Roadshow, Behind the Scenes. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, we'll take your questions and comments about Antiques Roadshow, the program, as we visit with Marcia Bemko. We're not talking today with her about trying to put a value on anything that you may own, so don't even bother to bring that up. But it's questions or maybe experiences that you've had with Antiques Roadshow you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. Orly in Osseo, Wisconsin, up first. Let's go to Orly. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is, have you ever had somebody find out that their whatever they had was such junk, they just left it behind at one of these shows where it's like, oh, well, I don't even want this because it's worth nothing. It was a reproduction or it was junk.
Ah, good question.
You know, you've hit the nail on the head. Every event that we produce where we see those 5,000 to 6,000 people, there are things left behind. So we leave them at the convention center in case they were lost and found. But usually it's a junky teacups and bad paintings and old prints and things you can see that whoever brought them, there was no sentimental value there. They were looking for value and didn't get any, didn't want to even lug it home. So it does. It happens every show.
All right. Thank you for calling. Bernice in Hayward, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Yes, sir. I'm calling in regards to bug eclipse, if she has ever seen them or heard of them.
B-U-G-G-Y, you're saying?
Yeah, bug eclipse.
Mm-hmm. Bug eclipse, I have not, and frankly, and that's what's so interesting about antiques, by the way, which is why even an experienced person can sometimes undersell something. I don't even know what they're for.
Well, they're, I'm not sure what they're for either, but I thank you, Bernice, for what is your background, or how did, you know, you've been doing the show for 10 years. Did you have an antiques background?
I did not. I have a television background,
yeah.
And I came out of a long line of producing, you know, news and informational types of television, documentary. But you have been covering the subject here for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so I know a lot about antiques, but it's not something a person can do, especially at the high end, successfully part-time. Just like an appraiser couldn't come produce a show part-time. It's its own devotion. Our experts are looking at objects 24/7 practically,
right.
7 days a week. And by the way, the interesting thing that even a young man or woman on our show has been in it for decades because, as a rule, they are the children of collectors, auctioneers, and dealers. And they come to it very, very young because really great things are one-of-a-kind type objects,
yeah.
And you're learning one-of-a-kind type things. You need to touch and see an enormous amount of stuff, frankly, before you can do what you see our experts do that looks so easy for them.
And, you know, you actually go through, I was quite interested in how you go back after the show is over and try and gain more information on the pieces that you've kind of chosen to be shown. and the people.
And what's so great about the web now and the meshing of these two, the technology helps us learn more, faster, bigger, better, right, is we do something on our site called an update. There's certain kinds of research that just can't be accomplished in the amount of time we have on that one day, especially when you're getting into that high-end a painting or something. You need to confirm, is it right? That's the kind of thing that takes a dedicated amount of research, and it's not going to happen in our time span. So we do the research, and very often it's in our guests' interest to make sure they get the research done, because the impact on finding out the information often impacts the price immensely. So we will follow up. We'll stay on it. We hope we stay with a guest, with our experts, to see if they're able to answer the question. Occasionally, a guest doesn't have any interest in answering the question, and in that case, we stay in touch in case they change their mind.
Well, one of the other interesting things I thought about in reading the book was the fact that it's not necessarily always the highest value. Of course, you love to see a million-dollar thing, I'm sure. But there's more to it than the value of an item that goes into whether or not a person gets on the program.
Absolutely. I think some of the best teachers that we have as far as items giving us great lessons are in the not-so-great ones. What we can see, what distinguishes them, so that you can recognize if fakes are the best teachers, frankly. And I'm often asked, why don't we show more fakes? By the way, we're showing as many as we can in that city. We are always looking for them, because when you know the difference between how a nail should look and how this one does look, you'll recognize it. And so they're great teachers that way.
Jeannie in Lake Mills, we turn to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. It was so funny. I turned on the show just as Marcia said, you know, once a family gives up their antique, they can never afford to get it back. I had just stepped out of an antique store. We're up on the second floor. I'm quite sure I was looking at this little walnut table that my grandmother had in her house for decades and decades and decades and decades, and I couldn't afford to buy it back either.
You know, and that, well, what happens too, and this is something else that people really need to keep in mind, there's always a cost to sell. Even if you're going online, there's a little cost to sell. But with an auction house, there's a seller's premium, and it's 20% is quite fair. And a dealer, a very fair price to pay you is about half of what they retail it for. That's how retail works. Yeah. Retailers pay half of what they sell it for. They have a store to heat and everything else. So, frankly, if you were sell it for $5,000 to a dealer, he's going to turn around and sell it for $10,000. Suddenly you can't afford to buy it, or even at auction, you're getting a little less because you pay a seller's premium. So it's a little vigorous in selling it, so even at the same price you sold it at, you don't have that same money.
Jeannie, I'm sorry you weren't able to buy that back.
Me too.
Oh, wow.
Was it very expensive now?
No, it's just I'm just broke. I'm unemployed and about to go back to school. I was looking for a bookshelf I could throw things on, or a little higher table for next to my chair. And I said, here's the perfect table.
Well, it's a young person's mistake. It's I have sold things when I was very, very young, and my kids were very, very young, and I look back now and I think, I wish I had that debt.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned to the gentleman who owns the stores I left, you know you're getting older when the percentage of things you recognize in the antique store just goes up and up and up.
Thanks, Jeannie. Thanks a lot for calling. Chris in Oshkosh, let's turn to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hey, I have a logistics question. I was at the St. Louis Convention Center when you guys were there, and for a different event, and saw signs directing people who were bringing firearms in for appraisal to go to a certain place. But I did not see signs for artwork or furniture or household items directing people to a certain location. And I'm just thinking that if you wanted to streamline it, you know, you should have had,
Let me explain to you what you saw, because you didn't get into the show. What we do with firearms, and by the way, not every state allows us to appraise firearms, but what we do is we have officers there who, before you enter the event and then get divided up into the category lines, are making sure the guns aren't loaded, making sure you have no ammunition, and are trigger locking the guns. and so that you can't carry them in there. They're not in there for an appraisal. So the line you saw was a safety line so that those guns are trigger locked. We have on our set, because of we have 5,000 to 6,000 people, we have both plain and uniformed police so that people are always being watched and no one's coming in there with an unlocked gun.
Oh, interesting. Thank you for calling. Lloyd emailed us from La Crosse and wondered, has the advent of Antiques Roadshow affected the price of antiques? It might be a coincidence, but it seems to me that prices move steeply upward as the roadshow became more popular.
Well, it's a really insightful question. It's a really good question. I'll give you an example of how not just the roadshow, but the internet had effects of prices on a very something like Disney sells, which is fun to talk about. You've heard us talk about it on our show. Back before the age of internet and before Antiques Roadshow, people thought that Disney sells were rarer than they are. Now, they're still very valuable items, but not nearly as valuable as they used to be because they are more common than people thought. So Antiques Roadshow has taught folks a lot that way. The internet has also had an enormous effect on collectors being able to communicate. And now they know more of what's out there. But I like one of the things I like that I hope Antiques Roadshow does, and listen, we've got about 10 million people a week watching, so that's the other, you know, 290 million people in the country who are going to miss out on what we all learn, is we just don't want, you know, back in the old days, there are people called pickers who cross the country and knock on doors to buy objects from your home. And back in the old days, if somebody had told you you had a bureau worth $20,000, you would have clicked your heels and said, that's great. It's not a good price if it's worth $200,000. And I think before Roadshow came along, most people did not understand that, frankly, furniture can be six, seven figures. I know I didn't.
Yeah. Here's an email from Byron, who isn't happy at all with the Antiques Roadshow. He says, I've applied for tickets for years, and all I get is a newsletter. There are no tickets. It's a setup. I'm convinced it's a fake. No one has.
He's going to make me cry. Keep reading.
No one I know has ever, in capital letters, gotten tickets. He thinks it's a scam.
Well, let me tell you, I feel very bad when I hear that. Let me tell you the odds. What we do is we give out, and then frankly, because of the economy, we have more people using our free ticket. We're going to give out a few less next year because the day goes too long for us. Next year, we'll be giving out to the public 3,200 pairs of tickets. That amounts to 6,400 tickets. The additional tickets, we give some to the public television station to raise a little money. We also reach some out for diversity, so there are special effort tickets, and we also give some to our sponsors. So what happens with those 3,200 tickets is that we give them out by random application. And by the way, we won't do it first come, first serve because we have a diverse audience. Not everybody is on the web. You can mail your postcard in or register on the website for tickets. We set a record in Raleigh last year where over 34,000 people applied for those 3,200 pairs of tickets.
Oh, boy.
So you can see, and a matter of fact, the least amount of tickets applied for last year was in Phoenix, about 17,000 people. So you can see that not even half, I mean, do the math on those different, what the different numbers are there, but even in a small amount there, 3,400 out of 1,700, it's less than 25%. So, it's very disappointing to us that there are more people who want to come who we can't see. But we'd be there all week if we saw all those people. So it's not a scam. It's just that it's statistically, most people aren't going to get them.
Jack and DeForest, we're on to you now. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I really miss the zingers. Up until 4 or 5 years ago, there was always one person on every show where the appraiser would say, well, what do you think it's worth? Oh, I was offered $6,000, but I wouldn't take less than $10,000. And then the appraiser would respond, well, you should have taken the $6,000 because it's worth about $50.
I love those moments, too. We're always looking for them. You have to watch. We still have them. I mean, make sure you're catching us every Monday night at 8. But we do have them. We do see a more knowledgeable collector out there. And so you do see people who understand more about what they know, so it is harder for us to tape the amount of fakes that we used to tape in the earlier years. And I think we deserve a little credit for teaching that.
Yeah.
But We're looking for them. We're out there with you. We love them, too. We love that kind of, you know, we're very, very evil that way as audiences. We love to watch other people get disappointed, as well as be happily surprised. But we're looking.
Okay.
Not the lack of looking.
And I think you mentioned 8 o'clock. I think that's Eastern time, so it's 7
o'clock. Oh, you're on at 7 there.
Yeah, 7 here. David in DeForest, on to you now. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. I just want to say your hour and a half, that's my favorite segment of the day. I very rarely miss you.
Thank you.
You had a great show, and I love Antique Roadshow. I watch it all the time. I was wondering, has it ever happened, or do they have to write some kind of a waiver or something? Someone brings in some very valuable piece, and the appraiser accidentally, like, breaks off an arm, or if it's a book, you know, the paper tears, or, you know,
drops the teacup and breaks it.
You give me 2010 nightmares. No, frankly, it has not happened.
Oh,
really?
We have not. We've had a couple of small incidences that weren't caused by our appraisers. As a matter of fact, when you hear that horrible sound, if you're a faithful watcher, you've heard it in the background. It's the guests destroying their own things. And then we like to joke when we pick up the shards that really it wasn't worth anything. But, no, you know, we don't. In the one incident we had where somebody claimed maybe it was us, it was something that we repaired, and it was a small repair, and it wasn't a damaging thing forever. And so, no, we haven't done that. Let's hope we don't.
Great. You've got some very talented appraisers.
Yeah, well, when
there.
It's worth that kind of money, you can see the – when you watch our experts and all that stuff that's happening, and if you're a longtime watcher, you once saw Lark Mason cry when he saw a Tang Dynasty lion, real tears from somebody crying because he finally saw something he wanted to see. These guys are careful.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, David. Karen in Portage, on to you. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. Could you steer me towards a very good book or a source for appraising and dating antique Native American trade deeds? There's Chevron's Russian Blues.
Okay.
I honestly can't point you to a specific book, I have to be frank. And I think one of the overwhelming things as folks enter the resource area of antiques is that there is an enormous amount out there, very narrow and nichey, and there probably is a book of what you're looking for. I just don't know it.
All right. Thank you for calling, Karen. Carl in Madison, on to you. Hi, Carl.
I am ecstatic that your guest is here because for the last 2 years, WHA Television runs a promotion for the show, you know, between programs.
Yes.
And on this promotion, it goes something like this. The guy says, $450,000? No way! It's been sitting on the back of a chair for years or something. And this has been driving me nuts. What was it, and why was it so valuable?
Well, do you have access to the web?
Yes, I do.
You can watch this on our website. This is Ted from Tucson. I love that guess. Ted from Tucson brought in at one time, it was the most valuable item we had ever taped. It was a first phase Navajo Chief's blanket, which you're talking about, and we appraised it for $350,000 to $500,000. And if you go to our website, it is on, we have an archive of all of our, most of them, we're working backwards, but of our appraisals, and you can sort and look for it. It's a Tucson appraisal, and that was good old Ted there.
I'll be able to sleep again.
Yeah, that's what it is. And by the way, because it came up earlier, Ted is one of our rare guests who did sell.
Oh,
but
did.
Interesting to note was that even though it was a family object and had been inherited from his foster grandmother, he was a man who had just retired who had lived in a trailer and had a mortgage.
Oh.
So he had different. He had great need, and he sold it in a private sale. The Detroit Free Public Museum has it, and that is there are exceptions, and that's one of those exceptions.
And he got it within the price range that was.
Yeah, he sure did.
Oh, that's good news.
I mean, as far as I know, with a private sale, it's not like auction. You don't have record. It's rumored that he did.
All right.
Yeah.
Corinne in Richland Center, on to you. Hi.
Hi there. I was at the roadshow in Madison last July, I guess. My daughter came from Chicago to come to Richland Center to get me because I had a Frank Lloyd Wright item. And I also had a map, a railroad map, about 63 inches long and wide. And she was to hold one when we got up there. We had a real fun time. But I've got an old guy, or she did, who just looked at the map and said, well, maybe it's worth $200. But I wanted the younger guy beside the old man to appraise my Frank Lloyd Wright, because it's Frank Lloyd Wright's last dream. It's never been made. It was supposed to be made in New York, where Ellis Island is now. And I still have it. And people around here, of course, they don't like Frank Lloyd Wright too well, you know. So I still want to see it built in Wisconsin someplace.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who was on the tables there at Madison, which is really digging it back into my memory, and I don't have it here. But if you were in that Prince area there, in that corner of the room there, where there were two different people, one doing Prince and the other one would be doing the maps, and it would be, it's two different kinds of experts. I don't know your railroad map, but I know we see a lot of railroad maps, and so chances are, you know, people often wonder, did the guy get it right? Because I think folks often wonder, is mine has to be much better than that? Our experts are even more anxious than you to find something of value.
Right.
And so the fact is that I can't see your railroad map. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know enough to know that maps is a rule. $200 probably is pretty good value for a railroad map.
Appraisers, Lee and Leslie, the most popular?
They're our biggest stars, our twins, Lee and Leslie. Of course, we have a long roster of other favorites. People love Noel Barrett. And people adored Richard Wright, who we just lost this past year, who did dolls for us. And the list is about 25 hardcore people, but we work with a total of about 150 experts.
And it must be kind of fun for them, too.
They have a good time, and as we're getting ready to announce next summer's tour, which we're announcing on January 4th, where, this is our 15th year of touring. And many of these people have been doing this for 15 years together, so people know each other.
It's like family.
What they described, that I wasn't there in the very first year. This is my 11th tour coming up.
Yeah.
But what they described, the experts described to me, is something I didn't witness. But that is, before Roadshow, Christie's and Sotheby's didn't talk to each other. During that, but they are friends, and everybody is friends. Even fierce competitors are friends.
Well, this is, I tell you what, I'm sorry we're out of time, because there's so much more in the book. I was fascinated by the whole process of putting the programs together. Marcia, thanks so much for writing the book and preparing it for us, and for being with us today. It's a real pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. Enjoy it. It was fun to write the book. There's lots of little fun secrets in there. And enjoy the Madison shows when they come. Watch that delicious guest with her Frank Sinatra letter.
Thanks, Marcia.
Thank you.
Marcia Bemko is author of Antiques Roadshow, Behind the Scenes. Marcia's last name, by the way, if you're going to look online for it, is Bemko, and probably know that if you watch the Roadshow, because she is the executive producer of Antiques Roadshow. And I tell you what, it was a real pleasure to be able to talk with her. Touchstone is the publisher. It's a division of Simon & Schuster. Lots of great pictures and lots of great information about what goes on behind the scenes. Coming up, we're going to talk about what may be going on in the behind the scenes in your closet, or maybe in your kitchen, with insects. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, joins us next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.